Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 27 of NML Crossing, where I am still reporting in from the squeaky chair inside the sick house. It's been a weekend, gang, and it is just proving to be very difficult to kick the sick. The wife is still down. One of our dogs is ill. Just been a pretty rotten weekend, I tell you what. But fingers crossed we are coming out the other end of it here. And on to better things. I'm still dealing with a bit of the... I don't even know what the hell it is. I'm guessing it's allergies since it feels very allergy-like. And it hasn't gotten worse. So hopefully that's, you know, all it is. But anyway, I do have a uncharacteristically busy day today, so gonna have to get right into today's book, which is Detective Comics number 724, which had an August 1998 cover date. The story is called The Grieving City, written by Chuck Dixon, with pencils by Jim Aparo, inks James Hodgkins, colors Gloria Vasquez and Android Images, letters John Costanza, edits Vincenzo Peterson, cover price $1.95. Now, we open on a pair of looters trying to yoink some copper fixtures out of a dilapidated house. Now, one of these guys is getting a little bit froggy and suggests maybe they ought to put it all back. Because, you see, he's currently looking directly at Batman and Nightwing. And so these goofs run away, comically. One of them bonks his head on an exposed beam. The other trips, falls, and breaks his leg. So maybe comically wasn't exactly the right word for it. Batman decides to leave him laying and says that the police will take care of seeing to his medical needs. Next, we see the original dynamic duo thwipping through Midtown, and it really looks like, you know, they're thwipping like Spider-Man here. Dick notes that this area of Gotham didn't get wrecked quite as bad as some other parts. And Batman says some stuff about bedrock, which is something we did discuss in that New York Magazine article that I won't shut up about. Dick refers to some parts of town as being built on sand, which is kind of like Flushing, Queens, and Rockaway Beach. He then nearly falls off a rooftop as a big chunk of it snaps off. Batman's there to catch him and pull him to safety, though. They look across the street and they see a very busy church. Like literal lines around the block, busy. So, you know, no atheists in a foxhole, all that kind of jazz. We shift scenes to sometime later. We're in Bruce Wayne's office at Wayne Corp, where he and Lucius are being visited by a local artist named Wynowski, or Wynowski. Wynowski? I wonder if there's something to that name. Why now? Anyway, she's here to pitch her design for a Gotham Quake Memorial Monument. Now, it's being estimated at this point that the very bad thing that happened resulted in over a million dead. Now, the sculpture she presents is of a firefighter. Not a man made out of fire, a man who fights fires. Oh boy, I'm not on today, am I? Or I'm just as bad as usual. Anyway, the sculptures of a firefighter knelt down holding a small child. I cannot speak. Now, she says that the actual sculpture will be 50 feet tall and crafted of bronze. Lucius says it'll be placed over the mass grave in Governor Square. Wynowski says that it'll be a vessel for the shared grief of a post-quake Gotham and a reminder of what they'd lost. Eyes then turn to Bruce for final approval. And, well, he's not a fan. He is not a fan of this. He calls it an abomination, in fact. He says it does nothing but commemorates failure. Calls it a 50-foot celebration of victimhood. He says he wants something inspirational, something to make the people of Gotham think of courage. He tells the artist to beat it, but assures her that she'll be paid for her time. We next shift scenes to... well, this is weird. We're checking in with Bruce Wayne's neighbor, J. Devlin Davenport. Now, this is of, you know, the Davenports, the theater district's Davenport Center type of Davenport. Now, he's crying over a broken golf trophy, while being consoled by his trophy wife. His tantrum is interrupted by the arrival of his Alfred, a fellow named Montgomery, who informs him that the power will have to be out of the house for a few hours this afternoon. You see, there's some heavy-duty repair work being done at Wayne Manor, and they don't want to blow out the lines. Now, Devlin, reasonable chap that he is, he stomps over to Wayne's place and rips into the foreman, Alfred, for the inconvenience. He also has to do a double take at our man Harold, and he thinks that it's Harold's driving this big crane, and he thinks that it's a child in the driver's seat, which is kind of cute. Now, this tantrum, too, gets interrupted by the ringing of J-Dev's cell phone. And remember, this is 1998. Cell phones weren't everywhere back then, and it was kind of a status symbol, I suppose. So this is just another sign that this Devlin guy is a yuppie prick. Anyway, the call he's getting really, really riles him up, and he declares that he'll be heading to meet with whoever this is he's talking to, and he'll be bringing a team of lawyers, and we'll check back in with him in a bit. Now, as he stomps off, Tim Drake enters the scene, and he and Alfie talk about A, how horrid J-Dev is, and B, how hard Bruce is taking the fall of his city. From here, we hop over to the GCPD HQ, where Commissioner Gordon wakes up a sleeping-at-a-desk Babs and tells her to head home to get some actual rest. He also tells her what a huge impact she's made on Gotham these past few weeks. Just countless lives saved, and all due to her, or mostly due to her leadership. Babs offers to stick around, but isn't exactly against going home. She's like, yeah, I'll stay, but yeah, I think a warm bed might do me some good. Now, Jim tells her that she can stay with him and Sarah if her place is unlivable, but we know that she lives in a Wayne building, so she is totally cool. Outside, Mayor Grange is being dragged over the coals by a gaggle of reporters here. It's a really good and somewhat subtle scene. We find out here, you know, over a million are dead, millions more are left homeless, Gotham City is bankrupt, and people are fleeing the city in droves. Over the course of the next few episodes and chapters, we're going to see just how many people and entities are trying to get out of Gotham City. And, you know, she's just being bombarded with questions, and questions that she couldn't possibly answer, not in a satisfying way anyway, right? It's just like, this is a lot. And so she just unleashes on these geeks. She's got tears streaming down her face, and she reminds everyone that, you know, Gotham hasn't had the best few years. You know, countless attacks from supervillains, you know, Arkham busted out of, not one but two plagues, and now an earthquake. What's more, in this trying time, she's come to find out rather quickly that on the national and global scale here, Gotham City does not have too many friends. And so she tells the news folk off, and then gets in her car to leave. Back to Wayne Corp, where Lucius is still a bit shaken by Bruce's outburst at the artist. Bruce apologizes, but holds to his opinion that the pitched statue would elicit the wrong sort of emotion. You see, he doesn't want anyone to pity Gotham, just like he didn't want people to pity him when his parents were murdered. He then asks for a sit rep regarding finances, which now includes not only Wayne Corp funds and assets, but money out of Bruce's own personal coffers. And Lucius says it's all good. Bruce, we've talked about this. Does he not understand money? Money is not infinite. It is a finite resource, but Lucius gives the thumbs up, and so I guess we're good. Now let's check back in with J-Dev Davenport. We find out that he's been called out to sign off on taking apart the fallen Davenport Center. Now remember, we did see the thing topple over the course of a few issues. Now it lays across Mir Boulevard and is really hampering any attempts at bringing in resources, relief, and aid. Now J-Dev, he's adamant that it just be left there. After all, he still owns it, and when the time comes, he'll erect it again. I'm not sure this fella understands how buildings work. I mean, it's literally on its side. Davenport, he threatens to rain down legal hell if anybody so much as moves a single brick of his fallen skyscraper. We jump to later that night, and we meet up with a group of newly homeless gathered around one of them trash can fires. Now, one of them, an older fella, he's doing like a shadow puppet show for the kids, and this puppet show stars Batman. Now, a woman tells him to stop because he's scaring the children, because, you know, Batman is just a boogeyman, he ain't real. But the fella assures her that, well, he is real. But, well, he ain't no Superman. He hasn't done a damned thing for the people of Gotham since the quake. And this little chat is being overheard by, well, Batman himself. And so the next thing we know, we're back at Mir Boulevard. And suddenly a bulldozer starts. A couple of the construction fellas there, they dive out of the way of this now moving bulldozer. But note that the driver looks like he's got some pointy bat ears. The bulldozer winds up plowing right through the wreckage of the Davenport, which opens up a pathway. One of the construction guys calls it in and says it must have been an act of God. We go back to J-Dev's house, and he and his wife are watching the news, and they learn of this act of God. And, well, old Devzy is beside himself. He lets out, like a Darth Vader meme, no sort of thing. From here, we jump to our wrap-up. We got Batman standing in the rain, and he removes his cowl and apologizes for failing to live up to a promise he'd made. And then we pan out to reveal that he's standing before his parents' gravesite. And that's where we leave it. Next time out, we are headed into Two Shadows in a Row, a two-parter. How about that? Shadow of the Bat 78, and then Shadow of the Bat 79. It's the blank generation. And, looks like it's going to be a fun one. Now, before we talk about our thoughts regarding this issue, we do have a letters page here. We actually have two letters pages. We have one that appeared in Detective 723, which was the Brotherhood of the Fist thing that we're not covering. But the letters in at the end of that issue do discuss Detective 719, which was what we covered in Episode 1 of this program. Now, there wasn't a whole heck of a lot said about the cataclysm in that letters page here. Just a lot of, like, very odd optimism about being back in crossover mode. Like, one of them actually said, thank God we're in crossovers, because they don't want to wait a month to continue their stories. Which, I mean, I can understand that. I do feel like that letter might have been given a little bit better, you know, more prominent placement due to the cheerleading of the new era. But, yeah, I mean, I can understand that. You know, it's almost like the Bat readers were trained into reading things on like a weekly basis with all the crossovers that had occurred throughout the 90s, that it might have been a little staggering or shocking or oddly paced when you're reading things month to month after that. Like we've talked about, the big number going around was a 20% drop in sales for the Batman books over the course of the interim between crossovers, you know, which is a pretty big deal. That's a lot of folks no longer reading not just one book, but a family of books. I mean, with those sorts of numbers, you'd almost assume that, like, DC Comics somehow lost the movie rights to Batman and were purposely burying him. Ahem. Anyway, the letters in that issue were all kind of that vein here. Nothing to really analyze or even dissect in there. But the letters for the issue we read today, they are a little bit more, I don't know, bullet pointable. So let's hop in. We're going to start with a letter from Charles in Louisiana, who took the time out of his day and put a stamp on an envelope and walked to a mailbox to send out a letter that just says, Detective 720 rocked. I mean, what people do with their time and money, I guess. Next up, we have Doug in Missouri, who loves Detective and thinks Detective 720 has been the best chapter of Cataclysm so far. And that was a very good one. That's the one where, you know, Bruce is in the subterranean stream thing trying to get out of the Batcave, and that was a very, very good issue. He does ask a bunch of questions about the post-quake status quo. Questions that, you know, we will be, you know, answering during our journey here. Stuff about the secret identity, the Batcave, the manor, and the city itself. Now, this is going to be a theme here. He thinks that Grant Morrison's decision to add Huntress to the JLA was a dunderheaded one. And he says that Batman would never allow that. And, you know, hell, he won't let her in on any, like, the Bat Family's own reindeer game, so how would he allow her to be a part of the JLA? Our man Doug says that it undermines her established character to be part of a team like that. And the response is pretty much a boilerplate, like, stay tuned, with promises that Grant Morrison has some big, big, big plans. And I mean, it's hard to argue. I'm a huge Morrison fan, but his JLA work really didn't do as much for me as it did for a lot of people, I found. I found that there was, and I mean, this was probably on purpose, it was like less characterization there, but that's kind of, you know, that's just kind of a Justice League thing, right? Members of the League always just felt like co-workers, rather than, you know, buddies, pals, outside of a few cliques, of course, but a characterization for me was very slim in the Morrison JLA, and it's a series that I always intend to go back and retry, but I never get around to doing it. Who knows, I might not ever do that, but it's hard to fault DC for pushing and promoting and defending the JLA book, because it was like the only thing that DC had at this point. It was like the only book in the top 25 from DC was JLA, and JLA was usually close to the top of the list, but that was about it. So I totally get them not wanting to, you know, poo-poo on Morrison's decisions here. Our final letter comes from Bat Turtle in Ontario, who also says this whole Huntress thing is weird. He says that Huntress leaving a dude to die in the subway flies in the face of her now being part of the JLA. He also says he's happy to see Harold back and really dug the reference to Ace the Bat-Hound. And just like Doug, gets kind of a non-answer. Mostly just making fun of his Bat Turtle moniker. But the actual concerns over Huntress being in the JLA, they don't get any kind of play. And you know, I miss the time when we could have discussions about stuff like who's worthy of being on certain teams. Because that, you know, that ship has long left the dock nowadays. We've got actual killers on, you know, the JLA and the Avengers, which were these elite squads that, I don't know, they seem to have a different kind of code than the second and third tier teams. I mean, like, Sabretooth has been an Avenger. Deadpool's an Avenger. It's just, it's ridiculous how much they've cheapened what it means to be part of the mightiest or the most elite teams in a universe. And I mean, of course, there's, yeah, sales and stuff to consider, but these sort of additions really hinder or harm the prestige of these groups, to me anyway. And I mean, I am more precious than most, but when you start having actual killers rub shoulders with Superman, and I mean, of course, Superman's done his thing a time or two, but generally speaking, it's just very, very weird. But and I mean, we were ushering into a very different time in comics back in the late 90s, turn of the century. So what are you going to do? In any event, I do welcome your thoughts on these sort of questions here. What are your thoughts on Huntress being in the JLA? What are your thoughts on Deadpool being an Avenger? I mean, is that something that hurts the... I don't want to say experience, but just hurts the reputation or the prestige of these teams in your mind, or am I just being a little too Chris about it? You tell me. But now let's talk about the issue here, because this was a really, really good one to me. I'm really digging these bits where Batman's kind of at the end of his rope. You know, I think that these scenes are where it truly hits home that we're in this completely new normal. I'm not used to seeing him quite this frazzled. And I gotta say, it's kind of a good look on him. Because it's powerful. You know, I've said it before, I'll say it again, you know. Batman is always the coolest, smartest, most together guy in any room he's in. Except when he's not. And when he's not, it's that whole, you know, if the flight attendant stops serving drinks, that's when you worry. You know, when you see Batman frazzled and, you know, second guessing himself, that's when it's time to, you know, put your seat up and tray table, you know, back where it belongs, because something might be happening, you know, something you should be worried when Batman's worried. Now, very powerful, especially as he overhears how little faith Gotham has in him right now. And we're not talking urban myth here, urban myth or not. It's not that they don't believe he exists. They just plain don't believe in him. Does that make sense? You know, like, yeah, he could be here, he could not be here, but what is he doing for us? What can he do for us? What does he want to do for us? Is he human? Is he someone who even cares about, you know, us poor, newly homeless people? It's pretty interesting there because, you know, I don't think, speaking for myself here, I don't think we think of Batman as having an ego. Not in like the most basic, superficial of terms anyway. Because it's interesting, and it's pretty fitting to see him react the way he did. Like, we already know he's feeling inadequate, perhaps bordering on useless. I mean, at the end of this issue, he's apologizing at his parents' grave for failing to, what, fight an earthquake and win? And I know it's more than that. And the apology was largely symbolic, or maybe a coping mechanism. But to me, it really did add to the helplessness and futility of the situation here. It's, at the end of the day, Batman's just a man, and there's only so much one man can do. Now let's lighten the mood a bit here by talking about Mr. Davenport. When I first saw these cutaways to old J-Dev, I kind of groaned. I thought he was being added as some sort of like vapid yuppie straw man that we could, you know, root against, while also acting as a, you know, comedic foil, comic relief sort of character. And yeah, he was both of those things. But he was so in a way that facilitated some very strong scenes during the latter half of the story. I guess, you know, it never hurts to give a face to an archetype, I suppose. It allows us to, like, sort of empathize while also being able to, like, take a step back and say, okay, screw this guy. You know, he's a dick. I thought the addition of Davenport here was a good one. It also served as a reminder that, you know, not everybody is going to come together in times of crisis. You know, there's going to be that person or that group of people who are only worried about themselves. They're not going to have that, you know, that they're not going to go through the hero phase or the honeymoon phase with the rest of the community. They're into themselves and what they have to do and what, you know, what they, how they get back to normal. And if anybody gets in their way, then that's their problem, right? So pretty cool addition here. I liked just seeing it from that other side here because I think so far, we've seen people complaining about how long it's taking for Gotham to get back on his feet. But we've also seen a lot of, you know, acts of altruism and heroism. And here we just got a guy who's a dick. And those guys exist. Those guys exist. So it's interesting to put a face to that and have a guy that we can, like I said, empathize with, but also actively root against. Now let's talk about Mayor Grange and the impromptu press conference. I thought that was a very neat cutaway, and it's giving me the, you know, the old bubbling subplot vibes, right? It feels like so much of the behind-the-scenes looming dread is being paid forward in these smaller, more subtle scenes. Like here, we learn that Gotham City has very few friends, which I'm guessing is probably going to come back around pretty soon. And we also get a handy, very handy reminder, maybe for new readers or just for readers with short-term memory, but we get a reminder of all the horrible stuff that's happened to Gotham over the course of a relatively short span of time. Like all the breakouts from Arkham, the Nightfall saga, you know, the town was overrun by lunatics. We had two plagues in Contagion and Legacy, and that was not very long ago. And then we had the Cataclysm, and that's a lot. And I mean, that all might happen in a single day in Marvel's New York, since everybody lives there and operates out of there, but this is different. This is Gotham City. This is a place that, doesn't even officially have its own protector. I guess your mileage on Alan Scott and Hitman may vary, but, like, Metropolis has Superman. Gotham City has nobody. There are some sightings of bat ears, and that's about it. Overall, I mean, if it isn't totally clear, I feel like this was one of the better, if not best, Aftershock chapters. I'm really enjoying seeing Batman take this emotional beating. It's becoming more and more apparent to him that in order to operate in this new normal, well, it's going to be anything but business as usual for him. And I hope we get more stories like this. Now, before we cut out of here, we're going to do a very special text message edition of the mailbag here. Got some texts, and I would share the number here, I feel like every time I put the email out there, I get signed up for like 4 new porno websites. So, I guess we'll keep the phone number under wraps for now. First, my buddy Dave wrote in, and he said, we've been talking about how the Waynes made their money and how long they've been wealthy. Well, Dave says here that he's not sure how often it's been addressed in the history of the DC Universe, but in the New 52 All-Star Western book, the Waynes are a wealthy family as far back as Jonah Hex's time, back in the late 1800s, which I did not know. I don't really read the Westerns, and I certainly wasn't reading, the New 52 Westerns. I think I might own one issue of that that tied into the Night of the Owls or whatever it was, but I doubt I read it. That's interesting news here that at least from the New 52 on, we do get an idea that the Waynes are old money. Don't know how they made it yet, but I guess it would stand to reason that maybe money might not be so finite a resource as we've been fretting over here. Because, nothing makes money more than money, right? Money makes money. So maybe Danny DeVito was right in It's Always Sunny. We make money. But thank you so much, Dave, for writing in and filling me in, because I had no idea. Next up, my buddy Walt wrote in. He says, I'm chiming in on annuals. I make an exception for Robin, because we talked about Robin having those weird annuals before the ongoing. He says, since he had Robin, Robin 2, and Robin 3, and then the ongoing, it's not much worse than a late ongoing with several gaps. And since I filed them just ahead of the ongoing / volume 2, I'm fine with associating them with the ongoing and filing behind it. I think it's mainly the post-2000s that annuals got so detached from their series. Though Marvel led the way doing their year, or, just numbering by the years, and then the team-ups that they had in 1998. As I mentioned, I worry about this kind of thing way, way, way more than anybody ought to. But I was going through some long boxes last week, and just doing some filing, nothing major. But I noticed that I don't even have a standard way I do it myself. Like, there are some books, like Uncanny X-Men, let's say, where, there are probably 4 or 5 Uncanny X-Men annual number ones at this point. And so I put them all at the very, very end. I'll have Uncanny X-Men volume 1 through 17 or whatever the hell it is now. And then the annuals go after them all together. Sometimes, and I'm trying to remember which box this was in, but which box was it? It might have been Nightwing, actually. I think it was Nightwing. Yeah, so like Nightwing, I'll have the miniseries, then I'll have all of Volume 1, then the Volume 1 annuals, then Volume 2, the Volume 2 annual, or I guess Volume 2. Boy, I'm lost, because the ongoing, I call that Volume 2, because there's a damn mini. Oh, Lord. Apologies. My head's going to explode here. I'm sure this is wonderfully entertaining to listen to, and as easy to keep straight as it is for me. But let me start that over. Nightwing, there's the miniseries. Then there's the first ongoing, then the annuals, then the second ongoing, then the annual, then the third ongoing, and the annuals. I don't know why I have them separated like that. Maybe it's because there's no legacy numbering on Nightwing just yet. I think issue 300 comes out in a few months. I think they're doing the legacy dual numbering come April I think. Maybe March. Maybe then I'll move them to the end altogether. I really don't know. But then we get into problems like what Walt's about to talk about here. He says, while Adventures of Superman reverted to Superman, I see it as having phased out the old Superman Volume 2. But I file Superman 650 through 714 behind Adventures number 0, 424 through 649, and 1 million. Since the numbering worked out, I put the annuals 13 and 14 with Post-Crisis Superman 1 through 12. Okay. Now that begs the question here, where the hell does 0 and 1 million go? And where the hell did both the zeros go? Because the New 52 had zeros. We had the 0 hour zeros. How do you file that crap? I remember posting a picture when I finally put all my Action Comics together. I had Action Comics thrown throughout like 8 long boxes. And my run of Action, I have a complete run going back to like issue 4 something. And I put them all in this like tremendously long line against my wall. And I put number 0 at the start. And people called me out for it. They're like, oh, you put 0 first? That's disgusting. How do you put 0 first? And I'm like, I wrote in, I'm like, this will probably not help my case, but I put number 1 million at the end. You know, I do it linearly. But I do know folks who do put them together like in release date order. Like, I think we're actually coming up to DC 1 million here on the show. We're not going to cover it, but all the books are going to be interrupted, I think, with a November 1998 cover date. And they're going to get their 1 million issues, which I find out that a lot of people have filed like right after whichever issue came out before it monthly. And I just can't wrap my mind around that, because like you can't go from issue 726 to 1 million and then 727 after that. So I put those at the end. I know some people don't even count them as actual like real issues, and they just put them like with one shots and stuff. But I don't know. What say you? What say you? Do you file in order of release, or do you just do number order? And what do you do about those troublesome series that have two number zeros with, you know, when you take into account the New 52, I guess, anniversary zeros, because those were to commemorate like the first year of the New 52 being a thing. And I mean, those issues don't even get counted as part of the legacy numbering. I know there was that Action Comics 1000 poster that I've got at the other house, still leaning against the wall because I can't hang anything up. But there's that poster with 1,000 covers on it, and both number zeros are off of it, the million issues off of it, so they don't even count them as part of the legacy. So maybe I'm just thinking way too hard. But what say you? What say you? You tell me. Now, Walt continues. For me, Post-Crisis to Flashpoint is one huge thing across the titles. That said, again, as it's the constant renumbering over the past 10 to 15 some years from DC and Marvel that have totally screwed up the long-term notion of, quote, an ongoing series, with the possible exceptions of Action and Detective. And that's completely true. And I'd even go as far as to say, you know, Action and Detective's legacy have been kind of wrecked by having those New 52 issues in there. You know, it doesn't feel like a legitimate 1,000. You know, it feels like a gimme. It feels like they cheated to get there. You know, when you think about just how special it could have been to have an actual, you know, 1,000 issues of a series without weird extra number ones and extra zeros and 23.1 through fours, it would have been just so much nicer to have a solid 1,000. Though, you know, I guess beggars can't be choosers, right? We take whatever legacy number we can get in this day and age. I remember being so psyched that Flash and Wonder Woman were put at like 750 or whatever back a few years ago. And they've both been put back at a new number one. I'm guessing that we will probably see another Action Comics number one and Detective Comics number one at some point in the next couple of years, because that's just how comics work now. It's pathetic, it's sad, but I'm actually shocked they've kept the legacy numbering as long as they have. I figured when Bendis came along with issue 1000 of Action, I thought the next issue was going to be issue number one again, just because Bendis needs to Bendis. But credit where it's due, they kept going with the numbering, and fingers crossed they keep it up, but something tells me they ain't. Hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully I'm wrong. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on that, Walt, and leading me down some rather labyrinthine tangents that I can hardly keep straight in my own mind. But if anybody out there would like to take part in these conversations, I encourage and invite you to do so. Of course, you can find me all the ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, all the social media places. You know, I ain't a hard fella to track down. But with all that said, we're going to wrap things up today. I want to thank you all so much for sharing some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it.